This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Welcome to Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. We are very grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Today, we'll be spanning the globe from Charlottesville to New Delhi, India, speaking to Priscilla Mendenhall, longtime Charlottesville equity activist who works to help immigrants with their real and practical needs here in town. We'll then turn to the Yamuna River flowing through India's capital city, right past the Taj Mahal. It was once considered sacred, stretching for 855 miles. It is now one of the most polluted rivers in the world. We'll talk with Iñaki Aldai, professor of architecture and director of the Yamuna River Project, a long-term multidisciplinary effort to clean up the river and improve the lives of New Delhi residents. If you have questions for our guests during the show, message us on Facebook at 947WPVC. Check out all our past shows on the station website, 947WPVC.org. Nancy, I must ask, are you there?
You must, because I want to be in on this show, so thank you for inviting me back in. I am here. I guess it's evident now.
Yes.
Yes, I am here. Speaking of spanning the globe, another week of epic storms, and, you know, are they coming from the Atlantic or from the White House? You know, it's amazing. Anyway, you know how people say, well, some people say, you know, pet owners resemble their pets?
Yes.
I think, like, sometimes I think the weather is resembling the administration. I mean, it's just the two are paralleling each other on their disasters.
And I think, as apropos for the show, I think our Earth is crying out. And I really long for the days when all there was to talk about was Lady Gaga, Taylor Swift, or some reality TV star. Oh.
I totally agree. Apparently, thank you for saying so. How I miss being upset and outraged at the Kardashians, who I just saw, which I know this is old news. Apparently, I think one of them, Kendall, I hope. Jeez, I hope I'm not saying that wrong, is pregnant.
Kylie.
There you go. Thank you. Thank you.
I paid attention. I think that Trump and Kim Jong-un should get a world wrestling show and just leave us out of it.
Oh.
Don't you think? It would be, this is what I think it would be, Rocket Man versus Orange Gestapo with his sidekick Jefferson the Elf, a.k.a. the racist Sessions. That was
nice. That is excellent. And obviously, I'm sure it would be pay-per-view. I'm sure, you know, this doesn't come for free. But I love the idea of just let's get this over in some mud wrestling.
Yeah. I mean, it's an alternate universe where world wrestling is our real lives. It's like you're reading The Onion every single day.
We could do, it could be Dottered Amano. That would really piss off Trump
right there. We don't even
give him the mono, right? Yeah.
I heard a Korean woman saying that the real translation of that word was really senile lunatic fool.
Perfect.
Right.
I mean, Rocket Man, honestly, it's not a diss. That sounds pretty cool.
I know.
I believe he's saying that because he can't pronounce or doesn't think he can pronounce Kim Jong-un's name.
Oh, that's true.
I know he loves nicknames, but I just think that Dottered right back at him was way above his pay grade, Trump's.
Yeah. You know, Ted Lieu has a petition that I signed calling for congressional approval before Trump can launch a nuclear first strike, and I think that's worthwhile.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw that. I mean, we're just trying. We're just grasping at straws, you know. Trying to grasp at straws.
Well, I feel that it's imminent now that we've got the applause of the soundboard.
I know. I couldn't find it at the right time, so I just stuck it in.
No, that's yeah. Excellent.
You know.
I can't imagine. I can't imagine actually. This is, you know, he's. You can just rein that guy, Trump. Who am I speaking about? How did it happen that these two crazy people, how did it happen, are, you know, a button away from, you know, just, you know, reshaping the globe, you know, minimizing it for sure, putting it, you know, in such disastrous harm's way. It's unbelievable that these two just can't shut up. I mean,
I know.
In there.
Have you been paying attention to Jimmy Kimmel lately?
Yeah, I have. Yes.
He's someone
with a microphone is saying such important things.
He said, I don't know if this joke's going to translate, but he said so many great things that were so on point. And he was saying how he doesn't think Trump knows anything about the bill. And he said he doesn't know the difference between Medicare and Medicaid. And he barely knows the difference between Ivanka and Melania.
So true. I mean, as always, he's got more tweets about the ratings of the Emmys or something than he does about his own, about the fate of, people hit by hurricanes or whatever. He's just so focused on the things that concern him. And I know that's not revolutionary, but yeah, there's no way he knows Medicaid. Every time he talks about it, as always, it's the book report that he didn't write and he's faking his way through it.
Right. So. And if anyone's listening from Maine, please call Collins and King, 202-224-2523. Mm-hmm. King, 202-224-5344, or your senators from Alaska about this latest horrible Hollywood elitist cosmopolitan bill.
I honestly don't get what takes the ones that Murkowski. I don't get what takes them so long to know that, or any of them, but in particular the ones that have voted no before. I don't get what takes them each time this comes up. Mm. Why does it take you so long? It is worse or the same as the one that you already voted on. Why do you have to, turn of all our stomachs in knots? Why can't you just say,
I think the answer is politics. I really, speaking of politics, let's get to some things going on because I want to get on with our really amazing show. So upcoming general election, as we say always on the show, is November 7th. Deadline to register to vote is October 16th. And then in that vein, today at McGuffey Park from 2 to 3, Tom Perriello is speaking to pump everyone up and for people to sign up to do things about the election, getting out the vote. It's called Save Virginia from Trump with Tom Perriello and Justin Fairfax. It's a rally at McGuffey Park today at 2 o'clock.
That is some good branding. Yeah. I like the theme. Sorry, go ahead.
Right. So back to our show. We have an amazing, amazing show. Our first guest is Priscilla Mendenhall. She is a longtime equity activist and anti-racist educator. She is the co-convener of the Charlottesville Area Immigrant Resource and Advocacy Coalition. Welcome, Priscilla.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, it's our pleasure. So tell us about this coalition. Why did you feel it was important to create it? What's going on with immigration now?
Well, the story really begins with what started to go on with immigration in particular after the election. As everybody may recall, once Trump got into office, he immediately issued an executive order to enhance immigration enforcement in the interior of the United States. It got less publicity than the so-called Muslim ban, the travel ban, but it was issued on January 25th, and it really materially changed the situation for folks who live in this country without documents. And that was the impetus for us starting the CRAC, the Charlottesville Area Immigrant Resource and Advocacy Coalition. That was the immediate impulse.
And who are the members so far? Who are the members so far?
Well, it's a broad array of people and organizations, including a good number of churches in town, individuals who, like me, have been doing this work for a really long time around equity and access for refugees and immigrants. So it's a network of organizations and people that's very loosely organized in the sense that we revolve our leadership and our structure changes to meet local needs.
And how are, so far anyway, how have you been engaging with the community? What sorts of efforts, what does it look like?
What it looks like is monthly meetings to bring folks into the fold who want to be there to support and protect particularly undocumented folks in the community. We have a series of working groups, which I can go into if you would like. The church folks are particularly concentrating on becoming sanctuary congregations. We have one church in town, the Quaker Meeting, which has in fact become a sanctuary space, the first one in Central Virginia. And they're working with a number of other churches to help them figure out whether this is something they want to do. We have also a working group that's looking at meeting the transportation needs of folks in the community who, because they do not have papers, remember this is Virginia, but if you do not have papers here, you cannot get a driver's license, which means that anyone who is undocumented is driving to work, to the grocery store, to pick up their kids from school, to go to the Boys and Girls Clubs without a driver's license. So we're pulling together folks who can assist them significantly with rides up to the immigration enforcement in Arlington, to visit family in the Farmville Detention Center, and to simply get around town. Another working group of the coalition, if I can go on with this, is focused on raid response, and that group has kind of moved away from the coalition and is now housed at the Legal Aid Justice Center. And finally, we have an advocacy group that is looking very critically at what the city and, by extension, the county are doing to put policies in place that will support not only the undocumented community, but all immigrants and refugees in the Charlottesville area. That's a long haul.
I just want to break down some of the things that you said. What do you mean by sanctuary space? And did you say it was at the Quaker?
So a sanctuary church, the sanctuary movement began in this country, or the modern sanctuary movement began in the 80s when folks were flowing out of El Salvador, in particular, across the southern border of the United States. And they came in without papers, and churches along the border, in particular, starting with Southside Presbyterian in Tucson, began to offer their spaces as shelter to people so that they would not be picked up by Border Patrol and, by extension, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. In recent years, with the change in administration, there's been a real impetus for churches around the country to consider becoming safe spaces for families who are at risk of deportation. Usually, they open themselves to families that are in their last kind of appeal process, or families that are at critical risk and have substantial need. And that's happening around the country. It's not an easy thing for a congregation to decide. It puts them at some legal jeopardy. Therefore, it's a very intentional process for congregations. But again, the Quaker meeting here went through a multi-month process of discernment around this and became the first sanctuary church in Central Virginia.
Wow. What are the legal jeopardies?
Well, technically, if you are a sanctuary church, or even if you offer to house people in your home, you are technically harboring an alien, and therefore you are at risk of being raided by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And essentially, if they come to your door with a warrant, there's nothing you can do. You have to open the door.
Can they prosecute you? Or
that has never happened thus far, but we're in a different time.
Mm-hmm. That's very true.
Yes.
And does it work?
Oh,
I was just going to say, does that work? Because we've seen, you know, clergy stand up at the rallies, and it certainly didn't.
It certainly has worked in other places. And I can tell you, having come to Charlottesville from Tucson a couple of years ago, the Southside Presbyterian, again, the church that started that movement in Tucson, housed a family for 2 years in recent years. And they eventually won the appeal, but that was under the Obama administration.
Mm-hmm. In your experience, is Virginia, what's your view of how Virginia is taking care of its undocumented, or protecting them, I guess?
I would distinguish between the administrative government of Virginia and the legislature and community in Virginia, okay? Last session at the General Assembly, there were I don't know how many bills proposed and actually passed by our Republican legislature that would have put even greater restrictions on the undocumented community. Fortunately, Governor McAuliffe vetoed them all, or the more reason to get out and vote in November, if I may put in a pitch. And, you know, the governor and certainly the attorney general they understand that undocumented folks are an integral part of this state, and so they're very supportive of initiatives. But we're constrained by what's called the Dillon Rule. And I'm not an attorney, but the Dillon Rule really impedes localities in Virginia from implementing policies and regulations that are not kind of sanctioned by the state itself. And unfortunately, even though the community in Charlottesville is very supportive of the undocumented and other immigrants who live locally, the city itself, and I'm going to go out on a limb here, the city itself hides behind the Dillon Rule, and it hides behind the fear of having funding, law enforcement funding, pulled by the federal government, which is a threat that was made by Attorney General Sessions and is now in court. So it's a complicated situation.
We're speaking with Priscilla Mendenhall. She is an equity activist, anti-racist educator, and we're talking about her group, CIRAC, the Charlottesville Area Immigrant Resource and Advocacy Coalition. How can people reach out to that, to you, and help?
I'll know a little bit more on Monday when we have a planning meeting, but you are welcome to go ahead and email me personally. We do have a group email, but it's a little, we're under technical difficulties right now. My personal email is PRILLDC. Used to live in DC. PRILLDC at gmail.com.
You may be visiting there, for all you know, legislation, so who knows. Which is my, actually, my question is, do you, how do you engage with the lawmakers lately? What's your plan?
Well, what the coalition has done lately is, let's backtrack a little bit. Charlottesville became a welcoming America city just in the, officially in the last couple of months. I don't know if people are aware of that, which means that we're part of a national network through Welcoming America that is committed to being inclusive and economically forward-thinking and integrating refugees and all immigrants into the community. The city is, we're in the middle of Welcoming Week, our first for Charlottesville. So the coalition went to the city with language for a resolution that would support the DACA recipients in our midst. That resolution was passed unanimously in council last Monday night, but what the city did with the language we proposed is they basically took out any of the policy requests that we had made. So our next move is going to be become a stronger voice advocating for policy supports, the first of which would be that the city commits to having no municipal agency, and that would include the police department, asking immigration status of anybody for any reason. That's where it all begins.
Yeah, no, that does make sense. How often do you hear stories about people that are now incredibly scared to walk around or drop their kids off, et cetera, et cetera?
Here locally, I think the community is afraid. It's not like the larger communities up in Northern Virginia or Langley in Maryland, where folks are keeping their kids home from school, where people do not want to get on buses to go to work. But people are afraid here. And there are definitely cases that we hear about of folks being picked up for a broken taillight, and then they're asked for their driver's license. They don't have one. And particularly in the county, they can be taken to jail for one offense. Once they are in the county jail, and it's a shared jail, Charlottesville and the county share the jail. Once they're taken to jail, they are fingerprinted. Those fingerprints go to a federal database which ICE can access.
This is 94.7 WPVC. You're listening to Apropos of Something. We're talking with Priscilla Mendenhall, co-convener of CIRAC, the Charlottesville Area Immigrant Resource and Advocacy Coalition. We're going to go to a break. We'll talk a little bit more with Priscilla about immigration, everything that's going on here in town and in Virginia. And then a little bit later, we'll talk with Iñaki Aldai, professor of architecture and the director of the very fascinating Yamuna River Project. Welcome back to Apropos of Something, everybody. We're talking with Priscilla Mendenhall. She's the organizer, convener of the Charlottesville Area Immigrant Resource and Advocacy Coalition. So, Priscilla, we were talking a little bit during the break. Tell us what your perspective is on what's been going on. You know, is this something, is what we're seeing something new, or is it not?
I think it's really important to remember that this is nothing new. This is nothing new, goes back several centuries and is part of a larger dynamic of excluding non-white people from this country. But in particular, with regard to the Mexican and Latino community, our history of deportations began in the 20s into the 30s when we deported close to 2 million people from the United States, 60% of whom were American citizens. deported them, so-called repatriated them back to Mexico, even though they were citizens. It continued into the 50s and 60s with the Bracero program, where we deported anywhere between 250,000 and 1,000,000 people. So this is nothing new, and we also need to remember that even under President Obama, we deported 2 million folks. And the majority of those people were not criminals. So it's part of a pattern. It's part of a larger context of marginalization and exclusion of others and bringing them back in when they work for us economically.
Because it is, you know, top to bottom, do you hear from, people that are students, professionals, parents? Is it span everything, the people that show up at your meetings?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The coalition, that was awkward. Yes, we do. The coalition brings together folks across, you know, all kind of interests. It's very intersectional. It brings together folks across different generations. The planning team includes a young woman who's in her very early 20s, into their 30s and 40s, and then I'm considerably older. So we look at things in a new way, I would say, and I want to be positive about the work of organizations like the Coalition. We hold ourselves accountable to the local Latino organizations, in particular Sin Barreras and Creciendo Juntos, and we are inclusive. Our leadership is revolving. It's a new time and a new dynamic for organizing in the community, and I'm really, really grateful and thrilled to be part of it.
I wanted to ask you about, you know, we hear so much about from the other side of the aisle or the other side of the from a regime, that the problems, the made up, really trumped up issues with undocumented people or even people different than themselves. Can you tell us the positives that you see? I'm sure you see every day what people contribute who are undocumented here in this country and in Virginia.
I think that's a great question, and it's very.
I do too, Ellen. I was going to thank you. Sorry, please.
That's a very crucial question, because, as Ellen said, the misinformation that's out there is pretty legendary. I would say in terms of the state of Virginia, we have about 250,000 undocumented folks in the state. And in 2014, those folks generated $500 million in business income. They also, and folks don't know this, they pay state taxes, Social Security, and Medicare. And I wanted to just give those numbers. They paid $200 million in state taxes in 2014, $382 million in Social Security, and $95 million in Medicare payments. And remember, this is a community that will never access Social Security and Medicare unless things materially change.
Mm-hmm. Do they not access that as a rule right now? Or
they can't.
They can't. That's what I thought.
They can't. What happens is, I mean, we could go into a long conversation about how it is that folks actually pay taxes in Social Security and Medicare, but the fact is that they do pay in, but they can't get anything out.
I just wanted to plug your email again, if I could, if people want to become involved and help out. The email is P as in Peter, as in Priscilla, PRILLDC@gmail.com.
Thank you.
You know, it is astounding, considering you would think that because all they want is that tax cut, for that reason alone, they would leave DACA recipients alone, because they are contributing to the GDP and contributing taxes. But that's how determined upside down they are about people of color being in this country. In your meetings, speaking of being more positive, what is the mood, what is the attitude when you guys get together?
I think the mood, I would say, is feisty.
Okay.
That, you know, and do that all in capitals. The mood is feisty, both in terms of the work that we need to do locally with the municipal government and in really expanding the reach of the coalition. Maybe the mood in this town is best represented by a festival, a fiesta that was a week ago today, actually, Civil Sabroso, which is the big Latino festival in town, happens once a year. A year ago, they had about 1,000 people. We had 4,000 this year. Mm. And it was a great cross-section of the community representing that feistiness as we danced and drank good rum.
What are your expectations for DACA? What do you think will happen now that it's being kicked around like a football.
I'm not sure what will become of DACA. I think that with the general mood in the country in support of allowing young people who are DACA recipients to stay here, that there will be pressure on Congress to actually pass the new DREAM Act. But at this point, I don't take anything for granted.
Sure. And in terms of Charlottesville, what is your view on those speaking out against law enforcement, collaborating with ICE? How effective has that been?
Well, at this point, I think that this is embedded within a whole larger conversation about law enforcement and policing in Charlottesville in the wake of July 8th and August 12th. So I'm not sure. I can't tell you. There's a lot that needs to be explored in all regards with regard to local law enforcement.
Is your organization in touch with larger organizations in Virginia or the U.S.?
Yes, very much so. We work fairly closely with the Virginia Interface Center for Public Policy, whose lead organizer, Lana Heath DeMartinez, has worked very hard to launch the Central Virginia Sanctuary Network and to be very active in not only in Richmond, but across the central part of Virginia. We work closely with the Legal Aid Justice Center, which is anchored here. And one of their anchors is here in Charlottesville, but we're in meetings so often that I always say we should just have one meeting a week and get it all done with. We also get information, you know, via email from a great many immigration organizations around the country and circulate it to our activists in the coalition so that everybody's apprised of what's going on.
And what can local citizens do to help?
I think the particular asks that we would have in terms of volunteer recruitment, if you will, we need drivers to be part of our transportation network to take people up north into Farmville and just around town. We also need folks to volunteer to get trained by the Capital Area Immigrant Rights Coalition to do visitation at the detention center in Farmville. We would love to have folks come forward who want to be part of a rapid response team. Those are folks who would be notified and go on site in the event of an ICE raid. And by the way, I just picked up an email this morning that they are anticipating very heavy ICE raids in the Northern Virginia area this coming week. And we can assume that some of that may dribble down here to Charlottesville. We also would like folks who can help just manage the coalition itself. We're all volunteers and people work full time. We're busy folks.
That's unbelievable you get emails like that.
First thing on Saturday, right.
Yeah, I never thought about it. Jeez. Do you have people that are moles or contacts, or is it easy to find this stuff out, or do you have to seek, is it difficult?
No, there's some communication with all these groups that's protected now. And I'm not going to go into details about that on the air, but most of what we find out are publicly released information from particularly the legal and immigrant justice organizations throughout the country.
I gotcha. And in terms of Charlottesville, do you see it as a sanctuary? I know that it claims that, but do you see it as a sanctuary city? Do the undocumented feel that way?
I don't think so. No.
No.
And I think, again, in view of what happened in the city over the summer, there's a very heightened awareness of the need to keep people safe. I'll give you an example. We had a joint meeting with the two Latino organizations just this past week, and I arranged for the meeting to have security, which never would have happened before.
Well, so thank you so much for being here, Priscilla.
Thank you.
Again, to reach Priscilla and to contribute in those ways she's mentioned, you can email her at prilldc@gmail.com. Thank you so much for coming to Apropos of Something.
And thanks to both of you.
Yes, please come back.
Sure. You know, Ellen, I swear, they always talk about the lowering of the bar for the president, but similarly for the people living here, it's like the pit of one's stomach just gets lower and lower. I know there was many uplifting things that we learned, but it's just, oh my God.
Well, let's use it as a way to leverage that to motivate people and to be active. I really think, you know, when you were talking about the money, why don't Republicans see the money coming in? You know why? Because I've I really, I'm boiling it down to just the authoritarian playbook thing. That's the way they're going to, that's the way they have been doing things. You know, this is nothing new. As, you know, I just recall back talking with someone about Turkey, many other countries. It's divide and conquer. You know, it's them versus us. And I just want to tell people, not our listeners, I'm sure of it, but people that I know, don't fall for it. You are being manipulated, you know.
That questioning authority, sure. I have some news of note about an authority.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I went on a little, went on my own little rant there. Okay, go.
It is more dismantling from Betsy DeVos, from the woman that allowed schools, fraudulent schools, to no longer be accountable to students that they cheat with loans. She's officially rescinding the guidelines and protections for student survivors of sexual assault afforded under Title IX, eradicating still another Obama-era policy. You know, the highest law enforcement agency is requiring the victims of sexual violence to meet a higher standard proof now, and making it, of course, tougher to file claims against their attackers. They need a preponderance instead of a preponderance of evidence. Rather, now they need clear and convincing evidence. It's just another both sides rationale.
Yeah, and we're going to have a guest on in October to address that, a professor from UVA, Nancy Deutsch, and she's going to talk a little bit more about that because we saw that coming down the pike. Thanks for bringing that up. It's horrible. Well, with no further ado, I wanted to introduce our next guest.
What a good idea.
Yes. He is Iñaki Alday. He's the Elwood R. Quesada Professor and Chair of the Department of Architecture at the University of Virginia, and he is the director of the Yamuna River Project. His architecture and landscape firm in Barcelona has received numerous international awards. Today we're going to talk about the UVA's Yamuna River Project, an international disciplinary research program whose objective is to clean up the river, rejuvenate the local environment, improve local infrastructure, and enhance public access to the river, and so much more. Welcome, Iñaki.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yes. Yes. So the Yamuna River is, it's in New Delhi, India, the capital city, which has a population of a whopping almost 20 million people. It flows past the Taj Mahal. And I know it was once sacred, and now it's becoming totally polluted, or it has become very polluted with untreated sewage, toxic stuff in there, and it was considered to be dead with no oxygen. How did it get like this in the first place?
Well, the state of the water is dramatic. It's a river that comes from the Himalayas. It's a goddess. It's the Yamuna goddess. It's one of the, like the Ganga, one of the big goddesses of India. And it comes from the Himalaya. It comes with a very good condition. And when it arrives to Delhi, 100% of the water is taken for drinking water for the city. And it's not even enough. There are other sources for the city. So the river is birthed again through the city of Delhi. And the problem is that most of the water that kicks into the river again is untreated water. But that's probably not the problem. And it has been, there has been a lot of investments of billions of dollars in heavy infrastructure, of course, like always happened with some corruption and other problems, but basically put a lot of this heavy infrastructure in place and the change has not been significant enough. So we tackled this problem trying to understand why. And discovering that the water is the symptom and not the problem, the symptom of a much larger problem. That is the change of the relation between the city and the citizens and the river from the Mughal time in the mid-19th century with the arrival of the British colonization and the cultural change between the people and the water. In the not only 150, 200 years ago, the emperor was the last one to receive water from the canal. So every single citizen of the city and the surroundings were keeping the water very clean for the emperor, who was the last one. that visceral relation with the water and the people living in the banks of the river and bathing and saving their soul through bathing in the goddess Yamuna has changed little by little to a complete removal of the presence of the river and all the water bodies of the city from the consciousness and from the physicality of the inhabitants. So from there, everything crumbles, and rapid urbanization, and in the end, the problem is a lack of equity in the city.
Mm-hmm. How did you get involved with this huge project, being so far from it?
Well, my partner Margarita and I have been working in rivers and cities for a long time. We came to Charlottesville 6 years ago as immigrants, so we are very thankful for being welcomed by the city. So thank you for your work, Priscilla, in your advocacy group. So when we were here teaching as professors of architecture, and I was starting a research project with an Indian professor, and we thought about which was the biggest urban challenge that we could imagine in India. And this biggest urban challenge was the second capital in the world, and the capital city of India, 20 plus million inhabitants, and a river with a 0% oxygen that has not a single fish or bird living.
There's no single fish in that river.
No single fish.
Oh, wow. We're going to continue talking about this project with Iñaki Alday. He's the chair of the Department of Architecture at UVA, and he's the director of this project. We will be right back. Welcome back to Apropos of Something. We're speaking with Iñaki Alday. He is the director of the Yamuna River Project in New Delhi, India.
And I think you were still talking about the how you arrived at, you know, managing this project. I don't want to actually ask you another question yet because I think you were in the middle of answering the other one.
Well, this thinking which is the biggest problem and how to test possible ways of attacking this problem. For us as University of Virginia, we are a research institution and we are an independent research from institution from any government. So we are not consulting in any way. Although we have an MOU, an agreement with the Indian government, that is very useful to get information. But it's really important that the UVA as a public institution with a global understanding and with a global concern of the big challenges is taking over such a challenge. For us, it's a really important platform for students and faculty.
And how many people and organizations, you know, do you deal with in a project like this?
Starting from UVA, we have departments from all over the university collaborating from, of course, engineering, architecture, urban planning, but also environmental sciences, religious studies, art history, politics, social sciences, the Batten School of Leadership, and we work and we have constant dialogue with agencies, with nonprofits, with think tanks in India, with professionals, with activists, with people who are guiding us and are our sounding board.
So how do you go about fixing this problem, and what are you hoping to achieve? What would it look like?
So we are working in two ways. One is producing knowledge. With this approach that is not about attacking the symptom, but finding out the causes. So producing knowledge in which are the religious implications in these polluted conditions, for instance, which are the political structures and the difficulty of the governance of the water and the Yamuna. And in our last exhibition in March 2017, this year, which was opened by our president, first time in India, we showed, for instance, in a diagram the governance of the water and the extremely complex governance. And immediately, in almost a month, the CEO, the director of the Water Authority, was in charge also with two other key agencies like Environmental and Forest and Irrigation and Flood Control. So we know we have impact even in changes of governance, in the sense that we are just showing what it is and maybe making some recommendations of possible ways to attack. And in that part is the development of a vision, that an alternative, what a different future could be.
Mm-hmm. So in this country, we have activism so far, still. What is it like in India? Do people rally around a project like this? Do they have any input?
Yes, it's very important to be aware that India is a democracy and is the biggest democracy in the world, 1.3 billion inhabitants. It has its own problems, like every country, but it's an open society with debate. In fact, one of the big challenges of governance in India is the extremely complex there's plenty of checks and balances. So in a way, it's difficult to get things done. So despite the latest times in which politics have been mixed with maybe religious approaches or different, more complex situations, still is a democracy, and it's a place in which the discussion is extremely open and it's very passionate.
Mm-hmm. Are there any additional issues because that river is considered sacred?
Just some months ago, the tribunals declared the Ganga and the Yamuna living beings, which means that if someone harms the river, is like harming a person.
Wow.
It's an interesting change. It's all very complicated and contradictory, because at the same time it's a living person, it's a goddess.
It's a living person and a goddess.
And at the same time is pristine, mm-hmm. and it's heavily polluted. Mm-hmm. And it's not the first time. The history in art history, in Indian art history, the goddess Yamuna has been polluted. And the representations of Krishna, mm-hmm. fighting the pollution, represented by a snake of 1,000 heads, mm-hmm. are part of the mythology of the history of.
So, considering that, was there a lot of, I don't know, are people upset about that? This is their sacred river, declared by themselves to be sacred, yet it's extremely polluted. How do you account for that?
The problem is the lack of accessibility and the removal of the river from the physical presence. When you talk to someone in Delhi, most of the people you will talk, they haven't seen the river in years.
Oh.
You only see the river when you cross huge bridges with fences, and you see maybe some water far in the distance. But you cannot access the river. You have to cross highways and
mm-hmm. So you talk about bringing the river back to the people. So in this project, I know that's... Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. So the water needs to be clean, and there are operations in process there, and it's something that we have to work with. We have always the debate when we discuss about if you are bringing people to the river, you need to have it clean before. And we always say, no, we don't think so. Because if we wait for the river to be clean, to bring people, it will never happen. Because you need visibility, you need transparency, you need accountability, you need to be demanded, mm-hmm. to your operations to actually perform in the process of cleaning. Mm-hmm. So it's a two ways, simultaneous approach.
Mm-hmm. Is that what led you, or what did lead you to deciding to make the river your project, the center of the city, versus relegating to the edge of the city?
Well, it's a huge river. The river is, as always, as most of the cities in the world, is the reason for a city to exist, to be placed. The river is the main resource for the city. It's your water, your irrigation, your food, your transportation. So you need to have the river back to the center of the city, to the center, physical and conscious center of the city. And you have an extraordinary river with a floodplain that arrives to be almost 3 kilometers, or almost 3 miles wide, 2 miles wide in some points. And it's a huge reservoir of space, for public space, for ecologies, for the river to grow, to flood, to go up and down as the nature of the river demands, and have this ecological heart of the city for a city of 20 some million inhabitants that has not had any operation of creation of public space since the 20s.
And a project like this, what do you see as its impact beyond Delhi?
Sorry, to impact?
Beyond helping the people of India, what is the impact, and maybe what can we learn from this, if I may?
Absolutely, right. Yes. It's probably one of the tests, the most dramatic tests of something that is happening all over the world. In some rivers in Europe, we have already gone through the process of restoring these post-industrial rivers that have been heavily polluted, also in the United States. But there are many rivers all over the world that has huge problems of pollution, huge problem of encroachment, and are the symptoms of a problem of inequality of the settlements that are around. And how you deal with this inequality of the city, so the life of the river is part again of reconstructing the life of the city.
Did you have something to do with the Barcelona River cleanup, the Besos or something? Is that right? Did you do this before?
Yes, we have worked in rivers in Spain, basically in the Ebro, which is the main river in Spain, with the Zaragoza Water Park or the Aranzadi Park in a tributary. And other projects. Our office operates from Barcelona, and we know well the process of change that Barcelona undertook from the 70s to the 90s and now. And we use Barcelona often to explain that the change in Delhi is not only possible, but it's just necessary. Mm-hmm. Because Barcelona, which now is a pretty city, very much appreciated, and lots of people coming, and a model for professionals for the planning of the city and the urban development of the city and the architecture of the city, in the 70s was called Filsirona, Basurona, because it was a filthy city in the 70s.
And really?
It was impossible to see the sea. There were slums, like the Delhi slums, of people living in the beach and being washed away in the storms. And a quite terrible condition. And there was a development of a vision by a group of people and universities and think tanks that was implemented when the democracy came and the Olympic Games were granted to Barcelona. And for that moment, Barcelona said, well, the Olympics is our opportunity, our excuse to get some investments and implement a vision of transformation.
We're talking with Iñaki Alday. He is the director of the Yamuna River Project that UVA has put together with a lot of different people and expertise, like we mentioned, civil engineering, land planning, anthropology, political science. It's an amazing project. Can we learn about it? Are you guys doing any exhibits at all here?
Yes.
Oh, good.
We have an incoming exhibition in the Smithsonian in D.C., on October 13, 14, 15, in the Accelerate Festival. And we had a series of exhibitions at UVA this spring, and a very important big exhibit in the India Habitat Center in Delhi in March.
So it's called Accelerate? Is that the name of it?
Yes.
So we can look for that in DC and then here as well. Thank you so much for being here. It was great to learn about this project.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Well, I know things on that scale just blow my mind, frankly.
No.
which, speaking of things in nature, I do have a palate cleanser that I can shoehorn into that.
Mm-hmm. Go for it.
Which is that we're in fall or autumn, however you fall on that word. So I have the best fall trees for, you know, leaf changing. Obviously, this is not something I do, but I know people go seek them out, right? They go watch the leaves change.
People do. Okay, people that do not live in New York City.
Yeah. So here they are. Tell me if you've heard of any of these trees from 1 to 5. The bald cypress. Apparently, you would like this one. No, actually, it's the next one you're going to like. No, this is the one. The bald cypress, Ellen. It goes from a majestic. It changes to a majestic orange red color.
Love that.
Bald cypress, number one, and then sugar maple, which has like a whole color wheel going on, and red maple, as advertised, and the black tupelo, which goes from orange to red to yellow to purple to scarlet, all on the same branch. And mm-hmm. lastly, the aspen, which
wow.
becomes a yellow. You
don't My favorite, I don't, well, I don't know any of those trees, but thank you. I love the orangeness of them. My favorite, I thought you were going to say my favorite is the ginkgo, which drops its leaves all at one time, and I really want to do that one day. Just happen to be under one where all the leaves fall.
I did not know that.
Yeah, and there's the ginkgo. I could go on and on about the ginkgo. It was like the only plant, I think, that survived an atomic bomb, which maybe we should all cling to some ginkgo right now in these times.
I guess.
Yeah, or in Hiroshima, it was like the only thing that really came back. It's very hardy. It's a very hardy tree.
Well, if it came in orange, it would probably be your best friend.
Yes, it is. It does get a little orangey, yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, well, thanks for bringing that up. So I could.
No problem. I mean, so. You know, I don't know. It just so happens, as you know, so I think that, well, this is our second day. Are you a fall? Do you say fall? Do you say autumn? What's your
deal? I don't know. Not sure.
All right. Well, I'm fall. So anyway,
I was looking at some dials.
First day, rather.
Sorry, I was looking at my dials here. We have like 2 minutes left. You say tomato. What did you say? You say fall. Let's not talk about fall and autumn because I have a palate cleanser. Which is, I noticed that Bill Gates, he's sorry about one thing, and this is what it is. He's sorry he implemented Control-Alt-Delete.
And he's sorry?
Yeah,
is that what you said?
Yes, he's sorry, and he wishes it would just have been one one control, and he blames IBM for the whole thing.
Excellent. What'd they do? How'd they
I don't know.
It?
I think that, I don't know the details, but that's about it with that. I mean, I don't know. That's all I know. I just found that really, really funny.
It's one regret and well, I guess it's okay since he seems to contribute lots of money to decent things.
Yes.
But he's focused on something so minor. Although I'm sure it was just an innocuous question and now it's gone viral and,
yes.
and et cetera.
Well,
et cetera.
Yeah, we need to sign off for today, but looking forward to next week. Check us out online at 947wpvc.org. Look at all our past shows. Our theme music is by Springtide out of Japan. And remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. Thank you. Someone who did something was the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. We thank them for their support of the show every week. Thanks, Nance. See ya.
Yep.